and to maintain their level of competence, we gave them ongoing evaluation and feedback on these competencies. It has to permeate the culture of the group giving the training. In general, we pattern our behavior after high-status people in our organization, which means we can take on their negative habits as well as positive ones. When workers are exposed to an intemperate supervisor, say one who arbitrarily reprimands people, they tend to become less tolerant and more harsh in their own leadership style. At Eastman Kodak, a manager told me, in the old days, everyone was in the same place, here in Rochester, sitting next to each other. You'd see someone every day, get to know their style, get mentored, or just be exposed to good role models, people who knew how to establish rapport, listen well, build trust, be respected. But now people are scattered all over, isolated in smaller units. You don't have the same chance to learn these soft skills. Because there is less chance for these competencies to be modeled and passed on, the manager adds, he feels the need to be more intentional in seeing that people in his unit learn them. We have a development plan to be sure we groom people in the skills that make people successful, not just the technical or analytical abilities, but the leadership skills, like self-awareness, persuasion, reliability. Encourage and reinforce. Take two nursing aides at a nursing home. One was callous and brusque with patients, occasionally even to the point of cruelty. The other was a model of compassionate care. The callous aide, however, always finished tasks on schedule and followed orders. The kind aide sometimes bent the rules to help a patient, and largely because she spent more time talking with patients, often finished late. Supervisors gave the cold aide top ratings, while the caring one was frequently in trouble and her ratings were far lower. How could this be when the stated mission of the nursing home was to provide compassionate care? Such gaps between the espoused mission and values of an organization and what actually goes on become glaring when people are being encouraged to cultivate emotional competencies that, in day-to-day practice, are simply not supported. The result is employees who are more emotionally competent than their jobs require or than is appreciated in their organization. An organization can help people upgrade their emotional competencies not just by offering programs to do so, but by creating an atmosphere that rewards and even celebrates such self-improvement. After all, our attempts to change are most effective in an atmosphere that makes us feel safe. To develop, a competence must be meaningfully flexed, and for that to happen, it needs to be valued at work, as reflected in the criteria for selection, job placement, promotion, performance review, and the like. That might mean, for example, rewarding people's efforts at mentoring and building coaching and training in emotional competencies into the performance appraisal process, opportunities for 360-degree feedback and competency training. A fledgling competence needs to be expressed during the actual situation at work in order to take hold. Lack of connection between the new learning and on-the-job reality means the learning will wither. As a training high evaporates, our enthusiasm for following through on what we've learned often fades. And whether or not an organization has a supportive climate is cited over and over by people going through training programs as determining the extent to which they can transfer what they learned to their job. Perhaps the optimal supportive climate for training occurs when an entire work group focuses on cultivating competencies together, as happens with some management teams at American Express Financial Advisors. In these teams, everyone, including the leader, makes a commitment to emotional competence training. Feedback and support are built into staff meetings, and time is set aside to talk about how people are doing with their emotional competence goals. In addition, the talent assessment for executives there uses a checklist that includes emotional competencies. Each senior executive completes the checklist on those in a unit, and each vice president does the same on himself or herself, says Cannon. Then they have a dialogue over those areas where they differ. The conclusions are presented to the company president. Things like relationship skills, motivating yourself and others, self-management skills really matter here. Shortly after taking the helm at Bankers Trust New York, the new chairman and CEO, Frank Newman, worked with a consulting firm to make top managers more aware of the human skills the company needed to stay competitive. The result was a program showing it was no longer enough simply to focus on the bottom line. Management skills would matter as much as financial performance for promotions and compensation. How could Newman get his bankers and traders to pay attention? He went to at least part of each training session himself, where members of the bank's management committee are among the teachers. As the bank's head of development puts it, "This way no one is saying, 'My manager told me it isn't important.'" Evaluate. The recommendation? First, establish sound outcome measures, especially for the competencies that were targeted in training, and include job performance measures. The best designs use pre- and post-training measurements, plus a long-term follow-up several months after training ends, and control groups with participants randomly assigned. While this ideal may be hard to meet, there are alternatives, such as using people's baseline measurements in lieu of a control group, or comparing an individual's changes on targeted competencies with changes in those not targeted. And if a program falls short, that information should be used to improve the next round of training. But almost nowhere are these simple principles followed. Instead, there is a distressing gap between what research shows should be done and how training is actually conducted and evaluated. A survey of Fortune 500 companies found that chief training officers believe the number one reason to evaluate training is to determine if there is a payoff. Yet there was little or no hard evaluation of their training programs. The most common source of data was student evaluation sheets, followed by continuing demand for the training, more like popularity polls than hard indicators of performance change. Research suggests no correlation between trainees' reports of satisfaction and their learning or demonstrated improvement on the job. As one review puts it, "Liking does not imply learning." The best method for evaluation, an objective pre- and post-training look at the impact on job performance, was not used routinely by a single corporation. 10% did report having used such a design on occasion, though many of those assessments focused only on people's change in attitudes rather than on any change in their on-the-job performance. But this is slowly changing. One of the most ambitious training evaluation projects anywhere is underway at the Weatherhead School of Management. There, the students who have gone through the managerial skills training program are asked to become part of an ongoing follow-up research project to see what advantage, if any, the cultivation of these capabilities gives them in their careers. The project is envisioned to go on for the next 50 years. Part 5. The Emotionally Intelligent Organization. Chapter 12. Taking the Organizational Pulse. At an international business conference I attended recently, people were asked, "Does your organization have a mission statement?" About two-thirds raised their hands. Then they were asked, "Does the mission statement describe the day-to-day reality of life there?" All but a few hands went down. When there is a glaring gap between the espoused vision of an organization and the actual reality, the inevitable emotional fallout can range from self-protective cynicism to anger and even despair. Companies whose profitability is won at the price of violating the implicit shared values of those who work there pay an emotional price, a burden of shame and guilt, a sense of tainted rewards. An emotionally intelligent organization needs to come to terms with any disparities between the values it proclaims and those it lives. Clarity about an organization's values, spirit, and mission leads to a decisive self-confidence in corporate decision-making. An organizational mission statement serves an emotional function, articulating the shared sense of goodness that allows us to feel what we do together is worthwhile. Working for a company that measures its success in the most meaningful ways, not just the bottom line, is itself a morale and energy raiser. Knowing what those shared values are requires what amounts to emotional self-awareness at the organizational level. Just as each person has a profile of strengths and weaknesses in the different areas of competence and has a certain level of awareness of these, so with organizations. For any organizational competence, these profiles can be mapped at every level, division by division, and down through each smaller unit to each working team. But few organizations take stock of themselves in this way. How many companies know where, for instance, blundering managers infect their people with rancor and fear, or where the pockets of enterprise are among their salespeople? Many organizations may think they are making these assessments through internal surveys of job satisfaction, commitment, and the like, but these standard tools may miss the mark. Some of the most widely used organizational measures were assessed by the Personnel Resources and Development Center at the U.S. Office of Personnel Management, under the direction of Marilyn Gowing. The question, to what extent do these surveys assess emotional intelligence at the organizational level? There were, as Gowing puts it, some amazing gaps in what was measured. These gaps point to missed possibilities in thinking about what makes an organization effective, and to ways of diagnosing performance lapses. Among the most notable gaps, emotional self-awareness, getting a reading of the emotional climate as it impacts performance. Achievement, scanning the environment for crucial data and opportunities for enterprise. Adaptability, flexibility in the face of challenges or obstacles. Self-control, performing effectively under pressure rather than reacting out of panic, anger, or alarm. Integrity, the reliability that breeds trust. Optimism, resilience in the face of setbacks. Empathy, understanding the feelings and perspective of others, whether clients and customers or internal constituencies. Leveraging diversity, utilizing differences as opportunities. Political awareness, understanding salient economic, political, and social trends. Influence, adeptness at persuasion strategies. Building bonds, the strength of personal links between far-flung people and parts of an organization. The importance for any organization of these competencies seems self-evident. As I write this, Microsoft's top executives are publicly bemoaning their organization's lack of political awareness, a deficit that has put them at seeming disadvantage in their struggle with the Justice Department over charges of monopolistic practices. Still, the extent to which each of these collective competencies predicts better organizational performance remains to be seen. But that is just the point. No one seems to be looking. Imagine the advantage for companies that cultivate these competencies, and the problems for those that don't. Let me make my point by sketching the differences for organizations, for better and worse, that three kinds of competencies can make: self-awareness, managing emotions well, and the drive to achieve. Blind spots. At the beach, on a hot August day, a family of four has packed up their towels, toys, and beach gear, and is trudging through the sizzling sand, when the younger child, a girl of about five, starts whining. "I want some water. Give me some water." Her father, annoyed at her whining tone, complains to the mother. Where'd she learn to talk like that? Then, to his whiny daughter, he says curtly, "Nobody hears you when you sound like that," and walks on, pointedly ignoring her plaintive plea. Through countless exchanges like this, often more covert and implied, each of us learned in our family of origin a set of rules about attention and emotions. The first rule: here's what we notice. The second: here's what we call it. The third: here's what we don't notice. The fourth: since we don't notice it, we don't call it anything. So with organizations, each has a distinctive zone of collective experience, of common feeling and shared information, that goes unvoiced or is spoken of only in private, not openly, and so falls into the abyss of what amounts to an organizational blind spot. Those zones of inattention can harbor potential dangers. At the Barings Bank branch in Singapore, for example, the fact that a renegade trader was in charge of both the front and back office operations, and so had no one supervising his trades, allowed him to lose hundreds of millions of dollars, sinking the company. For Archer Daniels Midland, the agricultural giant, a high-level collusion winked at price-fixing that, when exposed, resulted in indictments of several top executives. The organizational family. The rules that tell us what we can and cannot express at work are part of the implicit contract each organization imposes. Honoring these rules is the cost of being a member of the organizational family. We won't notice, say, that the manager here is a washed-out alcoholic who years ago had a better position but was part-tier to get him out of the way of top management. We'll just deal with his assistant, who actually does his job, the way everyone else does. Fear, which is not unreasonable, binds people to silence. Take the fate of whistleblowers, people in an organization who publicly reveal its misdeeds. Studies of whistleblowers in business find they are typically motivated not by vengeful or selfish motives, but by a lofty one, loyalty to the ethics of their profession or to the organization's avowed mission and principles. Yet most are victimized by the organization, fired, persecuted, sued, rather than thanked. They commit the ultimate sin, speaking the unspeakable, and their expulsion from the organization sends a tacit signal to everyone else. Go along with the collusion here, lest you, too, lose your membership. To the extent that such collusion keeps questions vital to organizational effectiveness from being asked, they threaten the organization's survival. It also contributes to frustrating group charades, like this example from a study observing top executive decision-making meetings. The subordinates were in agreement that too much time was spent in long presentations in order to make the president happy. The president, however, confided that he did not enjoy listening to long and at times dry presentations, especially when he had seen most of the data anyway. However, he felt that it was important to go through this because it might give the subordinates a greater sense of commitment to the problem. Business is business. In the early 1990s, Carl Frost, an American business consultant, was meeting in Sweden with work teams at Volvo. The talk was about the extra-long vacations everyone was anticipating that year. But Frost was disturbed by an ominous fact underlying the length of those days off. Vacations were being extended because sales were down. Volvo had a huge amount of excessive inventory on its hands, and with demand low, assembly lines were idle. The managers, Frost found, were quite comfortable, even happy about the decision to extend their holidays. But Frost felt the need to raise questions, to bring to the surface facts that the people at Volvo seemed oblivious to. The fundamental fact was that Volvo was losing the race in global competition for the auto market. Volvo's manufacturing costs exceeded those of every other major automaker in the world. It took Volvo workers twice as long to make a car as it took Japanese auto workers, and Volvo's overseas sales had shrunk in recent years by 50%. The company was in crisis, its future and the jobs of these workers in jeopardy. And yet, as Frost tells it, everyone acted as though nothing were wrong. No one seemed to see a connection between the vacations they were about to take and the troubled company's future. This blasé attitude, Frost felt, was a sign of a troubling failure of communication, one that let workers at Volvo ignore any link between their situation and the larger fate of their company. This lack of connection, he claims, meant they took little responsibility for helping their company become more competitive. The inoculation against such collusion entails making an organization more honest and more open in its internal communications. This requires an atmosphere that values the truth, no matter how anxiety-provoking it may be, and that seeks to hear all sides of a question. But such real debate is only possible if people feel free enough to speak their minds without fear of punishment, retribution, or ridicule. In a Coopers and Lybrand survey of Fortune 500 companies, only 11% of CEOs believe that messengers of bad news take a real risk in my company. But among middle managers in those companies, a third said bearers of bad news put themselves at risk. Among non-management workers, about half felt there was real risk in bearing bad news. This disparity between those at the top and those most in touch with what is going on day to day means that top decision makers may labor under the illusion they are getting all the data they need, while those who have the data, especially troubling facts, feel too anxious to share it. Leaders who fail to set a tone that encourages people to bring up all their misgivings and questions, including unsettling news, are setting themselves up for trouble. Then, says William Jennings, who led the Coopers and Libran survey, it is easy for employees to view internal controls as an impediment to productivity and to jettison them in a misguided effort to make the numbers. Lore has it that some years back, whenever new executives were hired at PepsiCo, then President Wayne Calloway interviewed them. He would tell them, the story goes, there are two ways to get fired here. One, not meet your numbers. Two, lie. But the fastest way to get fired is to lie about your numbers. If you withheld information, especially about a business disaster, he was unforgiving, a former colleague of Calloway told me. But if you were immediately forthcoming, he was very gracious. The result was a culture where people were very candid, very genuine, and open about the truth. Contrast that with what I'm told about one high-tech company by an executive. Telling the truth around here is career-eliminating behavior. Managing emotions well. One largely ignored pulse of an organization's viability can be read in the typical emotional states of those who work there. Systems theory tells us that to ignore any significant category of data is to limit understanding and response. Sounding the depths of emotional currents in an organization can have concrete benefits. Consider a gas plant division at Petro-Canada, the country's largest oil and gas refining company. Guys in the gas plants were having a wave of accidents, some fatal, I was told by a consultant who was called in to help. I found that in the macho culture of the petrochemical industry, guys never acknowledged their feelings. If someone came to work hungover, preoccupied over a sick child, or upset by a spat with his wife, his workmates would never ask how he was doing that day, or if he was okay enough to be sharp on the job. The result would be that the guy would be inattentive and cause an accident. With this basic insight into the human cost of ignoring emotions on the job, the company initiated a series of workshops for crews to get them to see that how they are feeling has consequences, that this matters. They saw that they had to look out for each other, and they were doing themselves and everyone else a favor if they checked in about how they were doing. If someone was off that day, they needed to say to him, "I don't think I can work with you today," and their safety record improved. This is not to argue for making organizations a place where people simply bare their feelings or souls to each other, in some nightmarish vision of the office as a kind of emotional salon or ongoing sensitivity group. That would be utterly counterproductive, a blurring of the distinction between work and private life that itself signifies poor emotional competence. From the perspective of work, feelings matter to the extent that they facilitate or interfere with the shared goal. The paradox, though, is that our interactions at work are relationships like any others. Our passions operate here also. As leadership expert Warren Bennis put it, people feel alone with their pain, the hurts, the loneliness, the closed doors, the things left unsaid and unheard. It's not permissible to discuss this. In too many organizations, the ground rules that marginalize emotional realities guide our attention away from such emotional static as though it did not matter. These blinders propagate endless problems. Decisions that demoralize. Difficulty managing creativity and making decisions. Ignoring the crucial value of social skill. The inability to motivate, let alone inspire. Hollow mission statements and empty slogans of the day. Leadership by the books, lacking zest or energy. Drudgery instead of spontaneity. A lack of esprit de corps. Teams that don't work. burnout? Blame the victim. As one executive at a high-growth company, where the turnover rate was recently at 40%, told me, people at the top work all the time. Many are candidates for divorce. We get huge rewards, but if you don't do better each year than the one before, you get fired. Job security doesn't exist here. Such plaintive reports are the new downside of a technological and competitive landscape that has escalated demands of every kind. It's constant whitewater, I'm told by a manager at a hugely successful company. There's so much turbulence today just from the sheer complexity of the business environment. You used to be able to come home and rest, but if you work for a global company, now you have to be available 20 hours a day, calling Europe at 4 in the morning, Asia until midnight. One way his company gets people to challenge themselves relentlessly is by making the reward so great. They pay more than anyone else, with many employees getting huge performance bonuses. It's a winning strategy for the company, but it often carries a high personal cost. Companies like this one can turbocharge productivity, to a point. The most driven workers will reap benefits, but if they are kept at this frenzied level, their personal lives, their morale, or their health, or all of these, will surely suffer. Few organizations address the extent to which they themselves generate the stress. More usual is a form of blaming the victim. Burnout is really a problem for the individual, one CEO told researchers. It does not have any real impact on the organization's productivity. It's a soft problem, not a clear-cut matter of finance or strategic management. If people want to use the EAP program or take their vacation days to get a good rest, that's fine. That's what those things are for. There's not much else the organization can do. The CEO's glaring errors. Assuming that there's little an organization can do, and that such emotional exhaustion has no effect on an organization's productivity. One of the defining signs of burnout is a drop in efficiency and the ability to accomplish even routine tasks. If that occurs, not just in a few individuals, but among broad swaths of employees, the organization's performance inevitably suffers. A study of burnout among nurses makes the point. In a large medical center, the extent to which nurses on inpatient units had classic burnout symptoms like cynicism, exhaustion, and frustration with working conditions correlated with patients' reports of dissatisfaction with their hospital stay. The more content nurses were with their jobs, the better patients rated their medical care overall. Since patients are consumers who make choices about where to spend their health care dollars, such human realities can make a large difference in the competitiveness of the hospitals those nurses work for. Consider, too, the risk when things go wrong. In a study of 12,000 healthcare workers, those departments and hospitals where workers complained most about on-the-job stress had the highest rates of medical malpractice claims against them. How to lower performance. Companies can do much to protect themselves and their employees from the costs of burnout. This is evident in a 20-year series of studies of the causes of burnout in several thousand men and women from hundreds of organizations. While most studies of burnout focus on the individual, this one looked at the practices and patterns in the organizations the people worked for. It pinpointed 6 primary ways organizations demoralize and demotivate employees. 1. Work overload. Too much work to do, with too little time and support. Job cutbacks require supervisors to handle more employees, nurses more patients, teachers more students, bank tellers more transactions, managers more administrative duties. As the tempo, complexity, and demands of work escalate, people feel overwhelmed. Escalating work erodes the downtime during which people can recover. Exhaustion accumulates. Work suffers. 2. Lack of autonomy. Being accountable for work but having little say in how to go about it. Micromanagement means frustration when workers see ways to do their work better but are held back by rigid rules. This lessens responsibility, flexibility, and innovation. The emotional message to workers: the company lacks respect for their judgment and innate abilities. 3. Skimpy rewards. Getting too little pay for more work. With cutbacks, wage freezes, and trends toward contract work and cutbacks in fringe benefits, like health coverage, people lose their expectation that their salary can increase as their career continues. Another loss of reward is emotional. Work overload, combined with too little control and job insecurity, robs work of its intrinsic pleasure. 4. Loss of connection. Increasing isolation on the job. Personal relationships are the human glue that makes teams excel. Shuffled job assignments lower a sense of commitment to the work group. As relationships fragment, the pleasures that come from a sense of community with workmates erodes. That growing sense of alienation fuels conflict, even as it erodes the common history and emotional connections that can help heal such rifts. 5. Unfairness. Inequities in how people are treated. Lack of fairness breeds resentment, whether due to unequal pay or workloads, disregard for grievances, or policies that seem high-handed. Rapid escalation of top executive pay and bonuses, while salaries in the bottom tiers rise little or not at all, undermines people's trust in those who run the organization. Resentments breed in the absence of honest talk. The result? Cynicism and alienation, along with a loss of enthusiasm for the organization's mission. 6. Value conflicts. A mismatch between a person's principles and the demands of their job. Whether this pushes workers into lying to make a sale, skipping a safety check to get things done in time, or simply using Machiavellian tactics to survive in a viciously competitive environment, the cost is to their moral sense. Jobs at odds with their values demoralize workers, leading them to question the worth of the work they do. So do lofty mission statements when belied by the day-to-day reality of operations. The net result of these organizational malpractices is to breed chronic exhaustion, cynicism, and a loss of motivation, enthusiasm, and productivity. Now consider the advantages for a company of raising its collective emotional intelligence. The spirit of achievement. The manufacturing company was losing a race with its competitors, who were getting price quotes for potential jobs to customers in 20 days, while those same quotes took this manufacturer 40 days to get out the door. So they re-engineered. They changed the quote-generating process by adding more control points, computerizing parts of it, and making other such structural changes. Result: the turnaround time for quotes escalated from 40 to 55 days. Then they turned to outside expertise, bringing in consultants who were specialists in re-engineering. The time for quotes ballooned to 70 days, and the error rate increased to 30%. Desperate, they brought in experts in the methods of the learning organization. Today, the time it takes them to get a quote to customers is down to 5 days, and the error rate is down to 2%. How do they do it? They change their working relationships, not the technology or structure. It's futile to try to solve with technology or structure a problem that is really a people problem. Nick Zanuck, president of Interactive Learning Labs, who led the company through the learning process, tells me. Zanuck should know. He won fame in the world of learning organizations for his pivotal role in a triumph of the method when he, with Fred Simon, led the launch of the 1995 Lincoln Continental, and their case is cited as a classic success story by Peter Senge of MIT's Learning Center. There's no question, the redesigned 1995 Lincoln Continental was a spectacular success story. Independent ratings of quality and owner satisfaction pegged the 95 Lincoln at the top of the Ford line, better than every American car in its class, and on a par with the best foreign competition, from the Mercedes to the Infiniti. Customer satisfaction increased 9% to 85%. Lexus, the highest scoring car, had an 86% rating. Equally impressive, though the redesign effort started 4 months late, the car arrived on the market a month ahead of schedule. And on every metric of production success, the new Lincoln met or exceeded goals, a prodigious feat for a process that involved more than 1,000 people, a core team of 300, and a budget of $1 billion. The challenge could easily have been viewed as entirely technical, a cognitive puzzle par excellence, that could be solved only by the smartest people with the most expertise. Auto design demands meshing hundreds of sometimes contradictory demands, from engine torque to braking, acceleration to fuel economy. The most intricate and difficult part of designing a new car is coming up with final engineering specifications for its components, a task akin to figuring out the size and shape of each piece of an immense jigsaw puzzle and crafting the parts as you go, during the very act of trying to solve it. Understandably, auto design teams typically have to backtrack and rework many of their design specifications after a prototype is assembled, because with the first prototype, unanticipated problems become obvious. At this point, once hot metal has been poured to make a working model, such reworking is quite expensive. The job requires redoing the machine tooling for every part involved, typically at costs of millions of dollars. Yet the Continental Design Team, with a budget of $90 million for those retooling needs, used only a third that amount, bucking an industry-wide trend to overspend the retooling budget. The design effort was as efficient as the Continental's engine itself. Engineering drawings for components were out a month early, rather than the usual 3 or 4 months late, with 99% of the parts in final shape, rather than the standard 50%. Hard results, soft means. The challenge facing the Continental redesign team was to get hard results, a better car, through approaches that many managers in the auto industry felt were just too soft to matter, like openness, honesty, trust, and smooth communications. The culture of that industry traditionally disregarded such values. It was hierarchical and authority-based, with the guiding assumption that the boss knows best and makes all key decisions. Compounding this cultural problem was a dense emotional fog. There was a pervasive sense of frustration at starting 4 months late, and a host of barriers to trust and openness. One of the main roadblocks was at the very top of the team. Zanuck recalls that the tensions between himself and the finance manager were so great, he couldn't talk to him in less than a high decibel range. That tension was a symptom of a deep hostility and mistrust between those in charge of producing the new model and those whose duty was to control costs. To tackle these problems, the core management team used many learning organization methods, including one that helps people unlearn defensive habits of conversation. The method is simple. Instead of arguing, the parties agree to mutually explore the assumptions that undergird their points of view. A classic example of how people jump to conclusions is when you see someone yawn in a meeting, leap to the assumption he is bored, and then skip to the more damaging overgeneralization that he doesn't care about the meeting, anyone else's thoughts, or the entire project. So you tell him, "I'm disappointed in you." In this learning organization method, that comment gets listed under a heading, "What was said or done?" The more critical data, though, is in another column, "Unspoken thoughts and feelings." That the yawn meant he was bored and doesn't care about the meeting, anyone else, or even the entire project. In that column, too, go our own feelings of hurt and anger. Once these hidden assumptions surface, they can be tested against reality by talking about them. For instance, we may discover the yawn was not from boredom, but rather exhaustion due to getting up in the night with a cranky infant. This exercise in learning to articulate what we are thinking and feeling, but not saying aloud, allows us to understand the hidden feelings and assumptions that can create otherwise inexplicable resentments and puzzling impasses. Beyond requiring self-awareness to retrieve those hidden thoughts and feelings, this task demands other emotional competencies. Empathy, to listen to the other person's point of view with sensitivity, and social skills, to collaborate productively in exploring the hidden differences and loaded feelings that surface. In a sense, the real conversations are the inner ones, if only because they reveal how people actually think and feel about what's going on. The inner dialogue, especially if it is emotionally turbulent, often seeps out in a truculent tone of voice, say, or an averted gaze. But we can miss these signals, in others as well as in ourselves, when things move fast or we are pressured or distracted. The net result: the inner dialogue is ignored, even though it is rife with crucial information, misgivings, resentments, fears, and hopes. As Zanuck puts it, we don't know what to do with this real conversation, so we ignore it. It's like toxic waste. What do you do with it? Dump it? Bury it? Whatever we do with this toxic waste is corrosive. It pollutes the conversation. If we confront people, they pull out their defenses. And so conversations at work go on as though there were no inner dialogue, even though everyone is utterly engaged in this mute exchange. The roots of conflict as well as the start of true collaboration are to be found in this deep level of discourse. When used at the start of the Lincoln Continental Project, the dialogue exercise revealed two bitterly opposed camps. The finance people thought those managing the program didn't care at all about controlling costs. The program managers thought the finance people didn't have a clue about what it took to build a quality car. The net result of this mutual exploration of hidden feelings and assumptions was to make glaringly clear that the project was hobbled by a lack of trust and openness. The core issues. Fear of being wrong led people to withhold information. The boss's need to control got in the way of people on the team using their best capabilities. Suspicion was widespread. People saw each other as unhelpful and not to be trusted. Here, emotional intelligence becomes essential. To have a working group that can go beyond fear, power struggles, and distrust takes a reservoir of trust and rapport. The task ahead focused as much on strengthening the level of trust in the relationships between people as on surfacing their hidden assumptions. And that took a great deal of social engineering. As Fred Simon put it, "If I wanted to improve the quality of this car, my greatest leverage was in helping my team members develop better personal relationships and see each other more as people." Starting at the top. At first, people had a deep resentment and despair about their inability to do the work they needed to. They started with a blame the boss's attitude, Zanuck recalls. But as the bosses engaged, really listening to what they had to say, it switched to, "Okay, I can do it, but leave me alone to do my job." But no such thing. We're interconnected in our work, and we had to go the next step, learn to be interconnected. So the bosses became facilitators and coaches. The role of the leader was no longer just controlling and telling, but listening, providing resources, and stewardship. To facilitate these changes, the entire 300-person design team was brought together in groups of 20 to work on the real problems they faced together on the job, such as reconfiguring the interior of the car. As they talked through their problems, facilitators like Daniel Kim, then at MIT, taught them the basic conceptual tools of collaborative learning. But the key was, as Zanuck puts it, emotional awareness, empathy, and building relationships. Fostering emotional intelligence wasn't a direct goal, but it evolved naturally as we tried to reach our goals. Consider again the challenge involved. 15 different design teams, each oriented around the parts of the car that performed a given function, like the car's chassis and powertrain, each working independently. But in the final design for the car, their efforts had to mesh seamlessly, yet they weren't talking enough to each other. Traditionally, each team would work in isolation to produce what it considered the best design, and then try to force designs for other parts to change to fit their own requirements. It was out-and-out turf warfare. If I make a design mistake in sheet metal and then have to go back and retool to correct it, that can cost $9 million, Zanuck observes. But if I spot the mistake before I get to the sheet metal tooling stage, it costs nothing to fix. If something's not going to work, we need the bad news early. In the typical design of a new model, there might be hundreds of small adjustments made to parts specifications down the line. That's why the Continental team had a budget of $90 million to cover the costs of these changes, a budget that usually is exceeded in the American auto industry. But in Japan, Zanuck knew, most such changes were being made up front, before the specifications were set in the tooling machinery, when they would become so expensive to adjust. We found we didn't know about these changes up front because the engineers feared being embarrassed or attacked, Zanuck tells me. They'd hope someone else would admit the mistake first and take the blame. They'd think, "Well, I can fix my dashboard mistake when they fix their side panel problem, and no one will notice I goofed." How do you get people to share the painful truth when they have such fear? But the crucial shift showed up, for example, in a new style for meetings. Says Zanuck, "We made sure everyone had a chance to share what was on their minds, instead of letting the old habits take over, where management walks into a situation thinking they have all the answers and are hesitant to admit when they don't know something. Instead, we'd put out a decision and ask, 'How do you feel about this?' Rather than the usual political jockeying and trying to look good that so often sets the tone of group meetings, this more direct approach took hold, in effect raising the group's level of collective self-awareness. When someone was uncomfortable with the decision that was being made, they would stop the meeting and use the methods they had learned to engage in a careful, respectful inquiry into the feelings and assumptions that fed that unease. There is a high probability that there was a reason for that discomfort, and that reason could frequently change the entire decision, Zanuck says. It took a while for us to reach that level of honesty and openness. He notes one concrete payoff for this more emotionally intelligent approach. We saw the team stop competing to meet cost and quality objectives at the other guy's expense and start working together. Instead of working in isolated islands, there was a constant back and forth. Once they saw the bigger picture, that my work is part of the other guy's, there were many, many trade-offs among the various teams. We even had some design teams give up part of their budget to let others add to the cost and quality of their part, something that just never happens in auto design. The bottom line? We got 700 changes in specifications 18 months before production, instead of the usual wave of costly changes at the very last minute. That let us save $60 million in retooling costs out of a budget of $90 million and finish ahead of schedule by a month, despite starting 4 months late. Chapter 13, The Heart of Performance. Appliance sales at GE had slowed alarmingly, and the manager was dismayed. Studying a chart showing a steady dip in sales, he and his colleagues realized the appliance division was having serious trouble with marketing. The conversation quickly turned to seeking a solution. Should they concentrate on pricing, on advertising, on some other change in marketing? Then someone from the company's financial services arm, GE Capital, displayed a chart showing that consumer debt was reaching saturation levels. It wasn't that the company was failing in its marketing, but that people were having more trouble paying for big-ticket items like appliances. Suddenly, everyone had a whole new angle on the problem, one meeting attendee noted. This fresh information led the discussion away from marketing to financing, searching for ways to help customers pay for such a large purchase. It was a moment when crucial information, a look at the bigger picture, arrived in time to avert the corporate equivalent of a minor shipwreck. This example illustrates the way in which an organization as a whole has an intelligence of sorts, just as do the groups and teams within it. Intelligence, in one of its most basic senses, is the capacity to solve problems, meet challenges, or create valued products. In this sense, organizational intelligence represents that capacity as it emerges from the complex interplay of people and relationships, culture and roles within an organization. Knowledge and expertise are distributed within an organization, and no one person can master all the information the group needs to run efficiently. The financial officer has one type of key expertise, the salespeople another, those in research and development still another. The organization itself will only be as smart as the timely and appropriate distribution and processing of these diverse elements of information. Any organization is cybernetic, which means being engaged in continuous and overlapping feedback loops, gathering information from within and without, and adjusting operations accordingly. Systems theory tells us that in an environment of turbulent change and competition, the entity that can take in information most widely, learn from it most thoroughly, and respond most nimbly, creatively, and flexibly will be the most adaptive. That principle applies to both the smallest corner business and the largest global firm. It points to the crucial role of information flow throughout an organization in determining its viability. Some discuss this in terms of how companies must use intellectual capital, their patents and processes, management skills, technologies, an accumulated knowledge of customers, suppliers, and business practices. The sum of what everybody in a company knows and knows how to do gives a company much of its competitive edge, if it is mobilized well. Maximizing the organization's intelligence. The tech reps who repaired copy machines for Xerox were wasting huge amounts of time, or so it seemed when Xerox analyzed how they went about doing their job. They discovered the reps spent a good deal of time with each other rather than out helping customers. They'd regularly get together at the local parts warehouse and exchange stories from the field over a cup of coffee. From an efficiency-minded perspective, this was an obvious waste of time. But that's not how John Seely Brown, Xerox's head scientist, saw it. Brown had sent a trained anthropologist to tag along with the reps, and this researcher believed the downtime was not wasted, but rather was central to the reps' ability to do their jobs well. As Brown puts it, field service is a social activity. Like most work, it involves a community of professionals. The tech reps weren't just repairing machines. They were also co-producing insights about how to repair machines better. The reps are knowledge workers, and their conversations are where their knowledge is transferred and built upon. As Brown observes, the real genius of organizations is the informal, impromptu, often inspired ways that real people solve real problems in ways that formal processes can't anticipate. Both work and learning are social. Organizations, as Brown describes them, are webs of participation. Key to successful performance with knowledge workers, with any workers, is instilling enthusiasm and commitment, two qualities that organizations can earn but not compel. Only workers who choose to opt in, who voluntarily make a commitment to their colleagues, can create a winning company, says Brown. That's where emotional intelligence comes into play. An organization's collective level of emotional intelligence determines the degree to which that organization's intellectual capital is realized, and so its overall performance. The art of maximizing intellectual capital lies in orchestrating the interactions of the people whose minds hold that knowledge and expertise. When it comes to technical skill and the core competencies that make a company competitive, the ability to outperform others depends on the relationships of the people involved. In Brown's words, you can't divorce competencies from the social fabric that supports them. Just as maximizing the IQ of a small working group depends on the effective knitting together of the people within the group, so with organizations as a whole. Emotional, social, and political realities can enhance or degrade what the organization potentially can do. If the people in the organization cannot work well together, if they lack initiative, connection, or any of the other emotional competencies, the collective intelligence suffers as a result. This need for smooth coordination of widely distributed knowledge and technical expertise has led some corporations to create a new role, that of Chief Learning Officer, or CLO, whose job it is to direct knowledge and information within an organization. But it's all too easy to reduce an organization's intelligence to its databases and technical expertise. Despite the ever greater reliance on information technology in organizations, it's put to use by people. Organizations that have such learning officers might do well to expand the CLO's or someone's duties to include maximizing the collective emotional intelligence. Emotionally intelligent organizations. The business case. We're a $10 billion a year telecommunications company, but our past leader was very autocratic. The group he left behind was like an abused family, a senior vice president confides in me. Now we're trying to heal the organization, make it more emotionally intelligent, so we can grow another $10 billion. We've just gone through wrenching changes, and there will be more of them ahead, a director of a European airline reports. We have an immense need for trust from our employees, and empathy and understanding from our managers, for a greater sense of we. What we need throughout the company is emotionally intelligent leadership. Our company culture has its roots in engineering and manufacturing, a corporate director at a high-tech company observes. We want to build an atmosphere of trust, openness, and teamwork that touches on people's ability to deal with emotions in a direct and honest way. But we find many of our managers are just not skilled in dealing with this emotional side. We need to make ourselves more emotionally intelligent. The quest to make companies more emotionally intelligent is one more and more organizations are embarking on, whether they use the term or not. An organization's collective emotional intelligence is no mere soft assessment. It has hard consequences. Mitchell Kapoor, the founder and former CEO of Lotus Development Corporation, now an investor in high-tech startups, told me that before his group puts its money into any company, they try to determine the company's level of emotional intelligence. We want to know if anyone is angry or resentful toward the company, if they harbor a grudge against it, Kapoor said. Companies have styles, like people. If they've been arrogant or duplicitous to their vendors, employees, or customers, those karmic debts can come back to haunt them. The more people they've angered while starting up, the more likely they are to be sued once they become successful. Perhaps the strongest argument for the economic advantage of emotional intelligence in organizations can be read in data generated by Jack Fitzends at the Saratoga Institute in a project sponsored by the Society for Human Resource Management. Since 1986, the Institute has collected data from nearly 600 companies in more than 20 industries, detailing policies and practices. They analyzed top companies selected for profitability, cycle times, volume, and other similar indices of performance. Searching for what these outstanding companies held in common, the Institute identified the following basic practices in managing human assets, their people. A balance between the human and financial sides of the company's agenda. Organizational commitment to a basic strategy. Initiative to stimulate improvements in performance. Open communication and trust building with all stakeholders. Building relationships inside and outside that offer competitive advantage. Collaboration, support, and sharing resources. Innovation, risk-taking, and learning together. A passion for competition and continual improvement. This list is intriguing because of the clear similarities between these organizational practices and the emotional competencies that typify top-performing individuals. The last, for example, describes a motivational competence, the achievement drive, described at the personal level in Chapter 6. Likewise with innovativeness, comfort with risk, collaboration, building relationships, open communication, trustworthiness, initiative, commitment. We've seen in earlier chapters how each of these emotional competencies is an ingredient of star performance in individuals. But here, these same capabilities have ended up on a list generated by observing top-performing companies, not individuals. Just as with individuals, organizational competencies can be thought of as falling into three domains: cognitive abilities, in the sense of managing knowledge well, technical expertise, and managing human assets, which requires social and emotional competence. But what does an emotionally intelligent organization look like? Consider the case of Egon Zehnder International, a global executive search firm. A global team. Victor Lowenstein had a dilemma, a global dilemma. Asked by the World Bank to locate a candidate for a newly opened vice presidency, he was told to search the world for the right person. It had to be someone with sophisticated financial expertise, of course. And because the World Bank was trying to diversify, preferably not an American, a nationality overrepresented in the bank's ranks. And Lowenstein, managing partner of the New York City office of Egon Zehnder International, was planted squarely in Midtown Manhattan. Undaunted, Lowenstein called into action the firm's worldwide offices. I sent a memo to about 20 different offices in the countries most likely to have pools of people with the required high level of expertise in finance, mostly in Europe, but also in Hong Kong, Japan, Singapore, and Australia. From these offices, Lowenstein received 20 profiles of possible candidates. He asked that the 80 he saw as most promising be interviewed by people in those offices to see if they indeed had the requisite technical competence. This eliminated two more. Beyond professional qualifications, says Lowenstein, The person needed personal qualities and competencies that would mesh with the unique environment of the World Bank. And as the one who had dealt with the bank, only I could make that final determination. So with a field winnowed to six, Lowenstein himself crisscrossed the globe to